Okay, now, our guest tonight is Richard Hoagland, and we're going to be talking about a 1976 discovery where NASA sent four Viking spacecraft to Mars to photograph the planet and test for the presence of life. Now, as part of the mapping sequence, one of the orbiters photographed a mile-long mesa that resembles a human face. Hoagland, who is the leader of the Mars investigation, discerned the presence of additional monuments and structures, including what is possibly an underground city, through careful analysis of NASA's photographs and consultation with scientists. The artifacts are the 1,500-foot-high human-like face and a surrounding complex of massive, hollow pyramids, possibly containing a message encoded in a geometrical arrangement. Now, Hoagland has now extended the Mars mission efforts to recent discoveries of artifacts on the moon. Last week we had Dr. Bruce Cornett on, and we talked about that. And Hoagland says compelling evidence may show that the solar system has been home to ancient extraterrestrial civilizations. Now, my guest tonight is Richard Hoagland again. He is the founder of the Mars Mission, a 10-year-old independent research team composed of researchers and lobbyists that are exploring possible artificial structures found on the 76 images of Mars by NASA's Viking spacecraft. He was a science consultant to Walter Cronkite, CBS News, and CNN. Hoagland designed space simulations and advised the networks on coverage of the Apollo lunar missions. In 1972, Carl Sagan, planetary scientist, credited Hoagland for the initial suggestion to include a recorded message aboard Pioneer 10. It is my pleasure to welcome Richard Hoagland to the program tonight. Good evening, Richard.
Evening, Michael.
Thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start by talking about how this one-mile monument was discovered.
Well, actually, it was seen by the Viking imaging team. As you know, NASA has sets up very extensive scientific investigations for all its missions, and a multidisciplinary team, and by that I mean scientists representing several different disciplines, meteorology, geology, solar physics, a range of sciences are represented on these teams. And on the imaging team, there was a score of geologists and planetary scientists who were engaged in both defining the mission, that is, designing the computer programs that would take the pictures, and then analyzing the pictures when the data was returned by means of radio from the spacecraft. And it was on a pre-recorded computer-directed frame, 35A72, taken of this northern Martian desert, coming back several days later as part of the normal mapping sequence that the Viking imaging team on a Sunday afternoon in 1976, so around July 25th, I believe, first saw this remarkable mesa, this enigmatic thing which looks like a humanoid face. And on a subsequent orbit over the same site, about 35 days later, the spacecraft was directed to take another series of frames of the same region at a higher sun angle, and those images successfully came back and were processed by the computers at NASA and at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. And all of this was subsequently released to the media in a series of news briefings that summer, a few days after they were returned to the Earth. So the first people to note that there was something remarkable in this Martian desert was NASA itself.
And they did go back, you said, and took more pictures of this?
It's one of the only regions on Mars during the entire mission, both the normal mission and the extended mission, which carried on, you know, after the money was supposed to run out for the normal mission over several years, where we have two different sets of data, high-resolution imaging at better than 50-meter resolution. That's better than 150-foot resolution, half a football field, in the entire mission. The spacecraft orbit was designed basically to get an overview of Mars and to get an overview of most of Mars prior to subsequent missions that were then planned to land unmanned robots, landers, rovers.
Right.
In the normal mission planning, because of the allocation of resources and scientists' other involvements and money, most importantly money, it would be very difficult to get dual coverage of more than one region. In other words, you'd get pictures taken at one sun angle, but hardly complementary pictures taken at different sun angles. And the Cydonia region, as one of a handful, like five or six regions that I know of, having looked through the data, is one of the key regions where we have dual sets of high-res data taken at two different sun angles. And I have always thought, since this problem first really surfaced for me back in 1983, that this, against the normal Viking mission, was rather anomalous, that somebody seems to have known even then that there was something important to rephotograph, because they did exactly what you'd expect to do. You know, they saw an anomaly, something that didn't fit, and then the first opportunity they had within the parameters of the orbit and celestial mechanics, because, you know, the spacecraft did not orbit over the same part of Mars every single day.
Mm-hmm.
They had to wait a month until the orbit geometry recreated itself, because Mars is spinning and the orbit is moving around, and it would take about a month to get it all back to where they could get a second set of pictures. The first opportunity they had, Michael, to get a second set of pictures, they took it. And again, it's like the circumstantial evidence that is being used in the Simpson trial. There is circumstantial evidence here strongly indicating that somebody at NASA knew within days of those first photographs coming in from Cydonia that the face on Mars was not just another pretty face.
Now, obviously, they tried to either, they've covered it up.
Well, nothing about this is obvious, so let's not use the word obviously.
Right. They did cover it up, then.
This is definitely obscure. There has been wheels within wheels within wheels, and lies within lies, and circumvention, and most of NASA absolutely does not know this is real. I am willing to bet dollars to Navy beans that most of NASA is honest, that most of the scientists who dismiss this, who shrug it off, who think we're kooks and crazy and all the pejoratives that have been used against us over the years, that they really believe exactly what they're saying.
So you think there's a small cabal at the
top? Is a tiny handful. And what's interesting is that if you begin to look at the structure of large institutions, if you look at the structure of the armed forces, the structure at the White House, it only takes a handful playing in a system where people presume the system is honest, where you trust your superiors and your colleagues, and it's us versus them, and us would never lie to us, for a handful to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, including those ostensibly on the inside.
Richard, when we went to break, we were talking about the discovery of the face and the subsequent cover-up by NASA, and where does that bring you in now?
Well, it wasn't until 83, which was a good 8 years, 8 or 9 years after the images were taken, that I really became entrained in this problem. I had been at JPL covering, along with a lot of other of the media, the encounter of Mars, the first soft landing of the Viking landers. I had, you know, been friends with Bob Jastrow for years, who was one of the key players in the investigation. I was knew a lot of the people out of headquarters and a lot of people at JPL, and there were like 1,000 of us, scientists and press and space groupies and whatever, gathered that Viking summer. And I spent the summer with Eric Burgess, actually, staying as a guest of his out in Northridge. Eric is one of the co-founders of the British Interplanetary Society, and he was covering the mission like all the rest of us, reporting, as it happened, the first in situ exploration of Mars by a U.S. robot. So we saw this face presented at one of the press conferences and some of the other things, and we automatically assumed that the whole thing was, you know, what NASA said it was, which is a trick of light and shadow.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be until 1983 when two gentlemen at Goddard, imaging engineers, Vince DiPietro and Gregory Molinar, called me and asked me for my assistance and help in getting, you know, someone at NASA to take their analysis seriously, that I actually really looked at these images for the first time and saw some pretty remarkable things. And probably more important than the things, I saw relationships between the things. DiPietro and Molinar had been focusing on this mesa, this face, and when I saw the photographs, what struck me was that the face was not in isolation, that there was an order, an arrangement of other equally remarkable geometric structures grouped in this very small piece of real estate, just a few hundred square miles, about the size of the Bay Area in Northern California around San Francisco, for instance, where there were other geometric anomalies that did not fit in with the natural landscape and appeared to have some kind of relationship with each other. They appeared to know that each other was on the landscape along with the others. And by that I meant they were aimed, they were aligned, there was a kind of a coherence that just appeared to be more like architecture than geology. But it would not be until 88 when, as part of this team I had formed, which was initially called the Mars Project and then evolved into what we now call the Mars Mission, I got the help of people like Errol Torin at the Defense Mapping Agency in Washington, who actually helped me crack the code of one of the key objects at the Cydonia site, which is not too far away from the face. It's a five-sided bilaterally symmetrical pyramid, which I called the D and M after DiPietro Molinar, since they had seen it on their analysis of their imagery. And it turned out that that's the equivalent to the Rosetta Stone of the complex, because what Torin found inside this one five-sided structure, which is roughly 2 miles on its longest side and has five sides, three short and two long, what he found was that there is this amazing mathematical symmetry and elegance communicated in this internal geometry, and that that geometry in turn is trying to tell us about very fundamental mathematical constants in the universe. And as you well know, Michael, the language of science, the language of physics, is mathematics.
Sure. I guess one thing that really impresses me too about all this is the fact that you have such a coterie of highly qualified people working on this project with you.
Well, they're out there. All you have to do is go get them. The thing that I found really distressing about the whole UFO thing is that there's an awful lot of, quote, investigators.
Uh-huh.
But there are very few scientists who've ever really looked at UFOs.
Yeah,
and the problem is not that they're not out there. The problem is that people have not done a management drill. They have not managed an investigation that would try to get to the bottom of what the UFO phenomenon is. And I was determined in the beginning, when we really began to suspect that we were looking at bona fide extraterrestrial artifacts built by someone not of this Earth, I was determined I was not going to repeat the enormous number of mistakes I'd seen in the UFO field over the years,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to try to invite, inveigle, seduce, suborn, cajole, coerce, whatever term you want to use,
mm-hmm.
real scientists, the best I could find, who shared a curiosity and a passion for the truth, and most of all, a willingness to put their reputations on the line and find out if this was real.
And, of course, that's the way you do real science.
That's the only way to do real science.
Now, despite this, though, you are meeting such a remarkable amount of flack and resistance from NASA.
Well, then before you say that, let's say that we're meeting with very interesting and mixed messages out of NASA. Remember
okay.
what I said at the top
sure.
of the show?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the system is honest. What we have found consistently over the years is if you can get NASA guys to sit down and tie them to a chair and show them this data, they will get intrigued. They will begin to help. They will come on board to the extent that they want to find out the answer. What's happened is that there's been a propaganda campaign within and outside NASA to keep most real scientists, be they working for the agency or not, from ever looking at this seriously. This particularly happened right after we'd presented our first scientific papers as part of the independent Mars investigation at the University of Colorado in the summer of 1984. I began looking at this in the summer of 83, and I went to SRI through a machination that is described in my book, The Monuments of Mars. We got a bunch of very good people to help, and an investigation was launched at SRI. And it took us almost a year to get to where we were confident enough in our preliminary results to publish a paper at a scientific conference to be held at the University of Colorado in June of 1984. Right after then, very shortly after then, there appeared an article by Carl Sagan in Parade magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of that article, it now is overwhelmingly clear, was to dissuade and persuade any other serious scientist not to get involved, not to take this data seriously. And the extent of that manipulation of the scientific paradigm and manipulation of scientific interest has been documented by no less a personage than the former head of the philosophy department at Sonoma State University, Dr. Stan McDaniel, in a book called The McDaniel Report, which is available through an 800 number that I can give you, you know, as we get a little further on in the show.
Okay.
And McDaniel, in his Chapter 9 of his report, documents the extent to which Dr. Sagan, the good doctor, manipulated the entire scientific process up to and including actually altering the confirming second set of images taken by Viking of the so-called face on Mars, in a gross manipulation of the process designed to keep real scientists inside and outside of NASA from getting involved. And for a while it worked, but it is now broken down, and every day more real scientists call us up and join this developing team to find out the truth.
Okay. Richard, before we went to break, we were talking about this this small cabal at the top and, you know, alteration of photographs and frames. I'm curious to know, what is it that you feel that you're dealing with here when you're talking about this group at the top? What is their agenda? What are they trying to do?
Well, up until a couple, 3 years ago, this would have been speculation. You know, we could make some informed guesses as to what they were afraid of, whoever they are, but now we know. There is a document, there is an official NASA study that was commissioned back in 1959, which McDaniel, as part of his documentation, uncovered with the help of people like Don Ecker and myself and some others. And this study was presented to the United States House of Representatives as official space policy during the first few months of the Kennedy administration back in 1960, when the Russians had just put a man in orbit and we were desperately looking for anything to keep our political fences mended with Capitol Hill. And so NASA stuck this document over on the hill and said, look, this is what we're going to do. It's a study designed to look 10, 20, 30 years down the road and to lay out the impact of space exploration on American society. It's called Implications for the Peaceful Studies on Human Affairs.
Okay.
And it was presented to the 87th Congress. There are major excerpts in McDaniel's book. There are major excerpts that we run from time to time in the Mars Mission Journal, Martian Horizons. And I have excerpts in my own book, The Monuments of Mars, coming up. The next edition will be out this spring. This document is very interesting because it reveals that the Brookings Institution, to whom NASA turned to do the study, was very concerned with the theme of extraterrestrial intelligence. In fact, they said on page 215 and 216, that it was most likely that in the upcoming years, 10, 20 years out, that as part of NASA's unmanned survey of the solar system, artificial structures and or evidence of inhabitants, intelligent inhabitants, would most likely be found on the moon, on Mars, or Venus. They have three possibilities.
Now, do you think that there's a possibility that the Brookings Institute had any kind of foreknowledge, possibly?
I don't think so. And I'll hold that question and remind me in a couple of minutes. All right, but it's a very interesting point. The next part of the discussion is even more interesting because not only did they calmly forecast that NASA might find this evidence, which we have now found, but then they discussed what NASA should do about it. Remember, NASA was created by Eisenhower in the waning days of his administration in 57, to basically civilianize a military space program. The Russians had put up satellites in 1957 in October, shocking the world, shocking us, you know, with their technological prowess, and our reaction was a sorry military mess. All the services were trying to vie for who would own space. And what Eisenhower did was set up a civilian space agency in July of 58, which basically took it ostensibly out of the hands of the military and gave it to people who should really be in charge, namely the civilians. and that there should be complete openness and honesty as part of the American space program. The honesty and openness was built into a marvelous document, the Space Act. The charter, the space charter of NASA, absolutely demands openness and honesty and integrity and full disclosure of all data. Now, here's what I believe happened. You asked your question before, did Brookings know something? Was it suspecting something? And my answer to that is no, and the reason is very simple. If anybody outside of a tiny handful of the military had known, had hard data, that there were other guys out there and that people were running around the solar system in UFOs or any of that, then they never would have allowed NASA's open cameras with an open policy on essentially live television to go to the moon, Mars, and all these other places and send back photographs. We certainly would not have found the photographs of Cydonia, not one set, but several sets, in NASA's files. I would not have been able, as part of the investigation over the last 2 years, have been able to go to the National Space Science Data Center and ultimately physically go to the data center and meet with people there and have them turn over to me thousands upon thousands upon thousands of feet of film, which are the record of priceless artifacts and artificial structures on multiple camera angles, multiple missions, multiple geometries. When you see our next journal, there'll be no doubt in anybody's mind that we have got it. The simple answer is none of that would have taken place if anybody had known beforehand. What we seem to be seeing is trying to lock the barn after the horse has been stolen. We send these missions out there in an honest effort to find out what's going on. We find out stunning stuff, but too late to keep it all locked up. And so what you've had is a rearguard action of deception, duplicity, and dishonor, lying and cheating and stealing on open NASA data in an effort to get people to kind of unring the bell, mm-hmm. to think we never went. And that's where all these weird stories, A, on the one hand, that we never went to the moon, on the other hand, that we've got these secret military alien bases where they're secret astronauts shuttling back and forth, you know, every 2 weeks, have come from. It's all part of a very careful propaganda campaign designed to make this whole field look silly, 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 to hide the absolute implacable reality.
Now, let me ask,
this solar system has artifacts,
sure.
all over it, not built by human beings.
Now, let me ask you this. Do you see anything at all that might tie into this with the firing of Richard Truly and the appointing of Dan Golden, who came from TRW and has an extensive black budget background, and more of a militaristic type of function of NASA now? Do you see any of this tying into this?
You want the long answer or the short answer?
Short answer. Got a little break.
Yes.
Go ahead.
That's it, yes.
Yes, okay.
I mean, to document, to back up that kind of a short answer requires a great deal of time and effort.
Mm-hmm.
But, look, Admiral Truly was fired literally days after he found a memo out of the NASA Lewis Research Center. Remember, one of the NASA centers that I've been invited repeatedly to present this data
mm-hmm.
of the investigation, the Mars Mission Inquiry.
Right.
Admiral Truly found a memo as part of an ongoing House investigation launched by the House Committee on Investigations, which basically was a blueprint for how to lie, cheat, and steal on FOIA requests. FOIA is Freedom of Information Act requests. And NASA, of course, because of the charter, and doubly because of FOIA requirements, is supposed to report honestly and fully any public and or congressional inquiries or press inquiries. There was a memo found by a congressman in Michigan. I forget his name. He has since resigned from the House of Representatives. But that memo came to light and was forwarded on to Admiral Truly, who launched a vigorous investigation of why NASA was basically suborning perjury. It was lying to Congress. It was lying to the American people as part of an official document, an official policy out of NASA Lewis. And when Truly tried to investigate, that is when he was summarily fired by President George Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle.
Okay. Just before the break, we were talking about this this changeover, the change of the guard, if you will, at NASA, and Dan Golden's appointment. The reason I brought that up, Richard, is I saw something that was posted on the Internet recently.
There's been a lot of stuff on the Internet, and not all that you read on the Internet is true.
Well, that's true. I realize that. But there's a posting from a Colonel Simon Worden, who apparently was head of the SEI, the Space Exploration Initiative, back in 84. They were discussing this, the death of the SEI, and Worden writes back, making a statement about NASA Administrator Dan Golden. You know, that he says, I'm quoting, that that Golden is also right that an extrasolar planetary detection program is a further step. Here again, the return is a funny form of, quote, security. Are they really out there at the edge of darkness? Does this sound like this reflects perhaps Golden's mindset?
Well, I don't know about Dan Golden. I mean, all I know is that the NASA program as we currently see it does not reflect the reality of what is on the moon or on Mars.
Sure.
And all our efforts to find out what is there seem to either fail ignominiously at the end of a 30-year process of technological development, or they never get off the ground. It's very interesting that the return mission to the moon, the first return in 23 years, was not a NASA mission, which had been called for over and over and over again by I don't know how many scientific panels, but was the Pentagon, was the National Naval Research Laboratory and the BMDO, the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization's Clementine mission, which secured about 1.8 million images, of which a handful have been seen. And there is no prospect in the immediate future that we're going to get to see any of them. And the new NASA mission that was announced a couple weeks ago in Aviation Week in Space Technology, which is supposed to leave next year, is going to carry an array of scientific instruments, but just amazing, guys, it will not carry a camera.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the mission that would ostensibly be under the Space Act. Remember, the Clementine data is not under the Space Act. It was carried out by the Pentagon, so technically it doesn't fall under the law that mandates that this show will be made available.
How convenient. Let's go to a call. We've got Brian from our affiliate KNRY in Monterey, California. Good evening, Brian.
Good evening. You're kind of real scratchy there.
Okay. What's your question for our guest?
Okay, I've got two questions, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, do you have any information on NASA Apollo lunar transcripts, either in audio or written form, and how might someone get hold of those if they are available? And the second question is, when is your upcoming news conference going to be concerning your new moon data?
I can see the word is out there that we're planning something. Yes, we are planning a news conference. We don't have a date yet. We're in the process of crossing the T's and dotting the I's. You know, we've just gotten some pretty amazing stereo imagery together of some of the artifacts, and I want to make sure that when we stand up in front of the National Press Corps that we absolutely blow their socks off with things that are unmistakable, that pass what I used to call the Stein grandmother test. My dear friend Harry Stein's grandmother could look at these pictures and could see lunar artifacts without computer enhancement. On the first part of your question, remind me exactly what you wanted to know.
What I'm asking for are the
The transcripts.
The transcripts.
Well, I would start by applying to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, the Johnson Space Center. They should have transcripts and notebooks filled with these transcripts and the tapes. We've not gone that route yet because, frankly, I'm much more interested in the photographs than I am in the transcripts, because the photographs don't lie, or if they do, you can catch them. It's very difficult to tell a modified transcript from the original unless you happen to be present at Johnson when the astronauts were in orbit. Now, I would recommend strongly that other people try to find transcripts and begin to look at the commentary by the astronauts, but it's almost irrelevant because I don't think that if they saw what we're seeing in the imagery, that they would have been dumb enough to say anything on an open mic channel anyway. I mean, the way I'm looking at this now is that the astronauts were very carefully briefed. They knew what they were going to look at. They took these pictures. The photographs came back, and there has been a great deal of deception to keep those of us who would look seriously from looking for almost 30 years. And I can't wait until we get our case to the point where we hold this press conference and we can lay on the table some of this data, because it is awesome. It is absolutely stupendous, and it will be part of the next journal, and it will be out shortly, within a couple, 3 weeks.
Okay, Brian, thank you for your call. Now, Richard, I'd like to ask you a question real quick. What happened to the Mars Observer?
I don't know. I have suspicions, but I don't have hard data.
What's your take on it?
Well, right after the spacecraft disappeared, which occurred under very mysterious circumstances, I was on ABC News on Sunday morning being interviewed on Good Morning America by a correspondent, and we were in a debate with Dr. Bevan French, who was the Mars Observer Program scientist out of NASA headquarters by satellite from Washington, D.C. No sooner did the interview end and the program was over at 11 o'clock Eastern Time then NASA officially called the Associated Press, Lee Siegel, who was then the science editor out in Pasadena, at 8 o'clock in the morning on the Pacific Coast, and informed Lee that Mars Observer had mysteriously vanished over 12 hours before.
Wow.
And they had waited until Good Morning America ended to announce the disappearance. Now, right off the bat, looking at that, you got to say, what were they doing? Waiting to notify the next of kin? Because, you know, we're talking an unmanned robot, guys, and it had several glitches on the way out to Mars. The press had been notified within minutes. Why, on this particular glitch, did they wait 14 hours till they announced to the world they had a problem?
Perhaps some executive decision.
Well, it looked to me, and again, this is speculation, as if there was a group gathered in Washington, watching television, watching ABC. And what they were waiting to see is whether the press, the media, would take the Mars mission seriously enough to force NASA to give us live imagery of Mars. And when it was apparent from the interview, and it's available on tape if you want to look at it, that ABC was taking us very seriously, because at one point during the interview, they basically asked Dr. French, well, you know, Doctor, why don't you just take the pictures and show these guys are wrong? And he never answered any of the direct questions directly. He never answered anything.
Uh-huh. Okay,
that program ended, that's when they made the announcement. So that got me suspecting strongly, if I didn't have any other reasons to suspect, which I did, that there was something not quite right about it, quote, disappearing.
Okay.
Then when I returned from Washington, mm-hmm. I began getting a series of phone calls through people that I knew.
Okay, Richard,
we're getting phone calls from NASA engineers that they knew.
Okay, let's pick this up after the break.
That it's alive and well.
Okay, that's Hoagland we're talking about, the face on Mars. Richard, elaborate real quick on this Mars Observer, that there's a possibility that it is alive and well.
I don't know what I'm hearing, but there have been calls from NASA engineers to third parties who in turn have called us here. Four separate occasions over the last year or so, ostensibly reporting that it's alive and well. And I have no direct information, but I must say that the circumstances of its demise
are pretty mysterious.
And again, the information being withheld over 12 hours
mm-hmm.
makes it very, very unusual, to the extent that it looks as if someone was waiting to see whether or not we were taken seriously in our call for live television and for re-photography of the Sedonia region.
Okay.
When it was apparent that they were taking us seriously, that's when it just disappeared.
Okay, give us the numbers now on how to get a hold of your videos and some information.
Well, if you want to follow the progress of this investigation, which now includes two other worlds, you know, the Mars and the Moon, it's 1-800-424-0031. That's 1-800-424-0031. There are a range of videos and books and other materials available. My book, The Monuments of Mars, the video series, which includes the NASA briefings, the UN briefings, the Ohio State briefing on the lunar anomalies that we did last June at Ohio State University, which is 3.5 hours, a two-tape set, which has some pretty interesting images on it. There is, of course, the books by Dr. McDaniel, the McDaniel Report. There are collateral materials by Stan Tenen at the Meru Foundation, material on the investigation of John Anthony West, Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock at Boston University, in terms of the Giza material, the Sphinx, the Giza Plateau, potential tie-ins to our work at Sidonia. There's a wide range of data now to look at, to peruse, to cogitate upon, to consider the alternative foundation to the whole UFO phenomenology, which is that this solar system has been host to a high-tech civilization of no mean capabilities, which has left structures, artifacts, remnants, ruins, in disrepair on at least two other worlds that have been photographed now by NASA spacecraft. And someday we're going to be able to tie all this together, that is the ruins and the potential builders of those ruins. But for now, the investigation is trying to proceed with documenting the existence of some pretty awesome and amazing things out there, which for reasons that are currently mostly unknown, the policymakers who control the information flow from NASA do not appear to want us to believe are real.
Okay, Richard, we've got a break there. This is the end of the program. Thank you very much for being my guest. We'll have to have you back. It's a very interesting topic, and unfortunately an hour just isn't enough.
It really goes fast.
Okay.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. We'll see you next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.